thank you all for coming to this launch event of the Decolonizing Curriculum in Theory and Practice Research Seminar Group, which has been sponsored by CRASH, the Centre for Research in Arts, Social Sciences and Humanities. We're really pleased to have you all here today, and we're hoping that this session will be really participatory in nature, so we're keen to have at least an hour for discussion, debate, feedback from you all, so that we can actually think about this project together as a collective. I just wanted to extend my welcome to you from on behalf of the conveners of this seminar series. So that's Monica Figueroa, Manali Desai, who are both from sociology, Adam Branch, who's from Polis, and my name's Arathi Sriprakash, for those of you I haven't met, and I'm in the education faculty. So, as many of you are aware, the call for decolonization is resonating in universities across the globe today. The most dramatic instance has been the Rhodes Must Fall movement in South Africa, which has inspired protests such as Rhodes Must Fall in Oxford and Why Is My Curriculum White in UCL. These movements have found affinities with expanding struggles around race, gender and class in North American campuses and with the upsurge of interest in decolonization within professional academia. So what we're hoping to do in our workshops and seminars as part of this series is focus on one particular aspect of today's demand to decolonize the university, and that is the curriculum. Drawing on post-colonial, decolonial, and subaltern critiques of social science knowledge, production, and circulation, our conversations aim to explore the post-colonial turn or southern turn in different domains of the humanities and social sciences. And so we actually have here today on our panel scholars from international relations, geography, as well as sociology. So we're hoping that we could have kind of a cross-disciplinary conversation to start things off. Our questions for decolonizing knowledge in the academy are fourfold. First, why is the demand for decolonization being heard so widely in universities today? Second, what place does decolonizing the curriculum have in these broader demands for decolonizing the university? Third, what are the experiences with decolonizing the university curriculum in different parts of the world? And fourth, what would it mean to decolonize the curriculum in Cambridge? And I'm sure that that's something that will resonate with many of your interests here. So to start us off, we're really delighted to have three speakers who have offered to give us 10 to 15 minutes of a response to some of these questions. And then Adam will chair a discussion, and I invite you to participate actively in that. So our first speaker is Kayinde Andrews, who's an associate professor in sociology at Birmingham City University. He's written a book, Resisting Racism, Race, Inequality, and the Black Supplementary School Movement, and is the director of the Centre for Critical Social Research, founder of the organisation of Black Unity, and co-chair of the Black Studies Association. Kayinde worked on setting up the first Black Studies programme in the UK at BCU, so hopefully he'll be able to share some of his experiences on that too. We also are joined by Karim Nishangyolu, lecturer in international relations at SOAS. Karim's research focuses on Eurocentrism in international relations and how is Eurocentrism can be subverted in both theory and history. In particular, his research has explored the ways in which non-European societies have been constitutive of European social relations in the early modern period. And some of his current research seeks to uncover the international origins of whiteness as a form of social control. And we're also joined today with Sarah Radcliffe, who's professor in Latin American geography here at Cambridge. Sarah's research interests include post-colonialism, culture and social development, geographies of contested post-colonial national identities. Sarah's the author of a recent book called Dilemmas of Difference, Indigenous Women and the Limits of Post-Colonial Development Policy, as well as co-author of Indigenous Development in the Andes. So without further ado, perhaps I could hand over to our panel and Chair Adam Branch. Thank you.
To go? All right, I'm going to stand, I think.
Yeah.
All right, so thank you for the invitation. Just tell me when to stop, because otherwise I'll just carry on forever. All right, so I'm going to briefly Just kind of give a bit of context. So we said we did have started the first Black Studies undergraduate degree program. Starts next year, not this year. But I guess I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to build up a bit of the context to that. So why have we done Black Studies? What is potentially different about Black Studies? And how can Black Studies deal with the ideas about decolonizing the curriculum? And I think part of that question is to address the why now. Why is it now that Black Studies emerges? And there's a positive answer and there's a negative answer, right? The positive answer is the social movements that students have started. Why is my curriculum white? Roles must fall. In the same way, if you look at where Black Studies starts in America, it starts when the universities open up. So pre-65, there's basically just rich white men at universities. And then you get women and ethnic minorities and you get different people on campus. And they come to campus and they're like, what on earth are you teaching? This is not the kind of knowledge which I thought I was going to be taught. And demand women's studies, Black studies, third world studies, a range of different studies. Right? And the same kind of things happening here. Massification of higher education, you have ethnic minorities, you have working class in universities, but again, people are looking around and saying, what is the content of this education? Is it what I want? Right? So Black Studies is part of that movement. The negative thing about why now, though, also, we should go into this debate and discussion about how much we can decolonize the curriculum, is it isn't a coincidence that it is with 9,000 pound fees. If I'd gone to my university when the university was free, or when there were caps on places and said, can we do Black Studies, they would have said no. Straight away, they would have said no. They're very positive at BCU about Black Studies because it makes money, right? It's new. It's a big new story, and they can generate income that other universities can't generate. So it very much does fit into the neoliberal agenda of universities, right? We can sell it, we can charge for it, therefore we will do it, right? So this is something which I am very, very, very conscious of with Black Studies, because this isn't the point of Black Studies. And actually what we're doing with Black Studies, as I explain, is really trying to change not just the face of the academy, but also what do we do? What's the work that we do? How does that work get generated? What is our day-to-day experience of academia? So I think this is part of the problem. Because if you look at why is your curriculum white, I mean, the answer is pretty straightforward, right? There's a quote which I wish I had come up with, but I didn't. It was Deepa Nayak, who organizes This Is Not a Gateway, says the university is not racist. The university is racism. And that's really important to take on board, right? What idea of racism is legitimized, has been legitimized by university knowledge from the day, right? It's only very recently we think of universities as progressive. Pre-1965, universities weren't progressive at all. 4% of the population went, there were places of white privilege. It was universities who came up with the idea of the hierarchy of the species. It was universities who came up with eugenics. It was universities who came up with racial science. It was universities in my community don't have a very good reputation. Me going around saying I'm Dr. Andrews doing sociology, that don't play very well to ordinary people. I'll be honest, they're just like, well, why should we listen to you, right? And it's legitimate. Because there's this idea that universities are bastions of progressiveness. We have to get rid of that straight away. The university is the master's house. The university is the master's house. One of the roles of university is to reproduce the inequalities we see in the society. It has been historically, and it still is today. That hasn't changed just because there's black people in the university. That is still the role of university. We're quick to criticize the school system. The school system is terrible, it's exclusive, exclusionary, et cetera, and then somehow when you get to university, we think things have changed. Actually, the attainment gap in universities is worse than the attainment gap is in school. If you look at who gets 2-1, it's terrible, terrible. And these are ethnic minority groups who do very well in school, still do very badly in universities. So actually, universities replicate these worse than the school system, which we're quick to critique, right? So we have to understand that the point of the university is not to make things any better. The point of the university is to hand out credentials, which make things just as bad as they were, reproduced system that we are in. So your curriculum is white because the university is racism. That is the point, right? So this makes it difficult for someone like myself, certainly, because I talk about radical stuff, radical politics, writing a book about black radicalism sounds nice, right? But when I put this to my students, I taught this to my students the other day, and I said, well, if the university is the master's house, what is my role in it? And this one student came and said it straight away, you are an overseer. An overseer of racism. This is my point. Not the top of the mess. I'm not the top of it, but my job is actually to reproduce the system in the same way the overseer did on the plantation. And you know what? That student's not wrong. They're 100% right. Our role, we are a master's tool in what we do. The academic industrial complex, the day-to-day 50 hours a week bread and butter that I do, doesn't help anybody apart. It just reproduces this system. And that's a difficult thing to say, right? Because I would like to think I'm quite progressive. I would like to think I'm doing things positively. But if I'm honest, 100% honest with myself, this is why I'm doing, right? So this is a challenge, and it's a challenge I'm putting out to everybody. This also applies to everybody. If this is the case, does that mean you just abandon university? You could say that, and I might say that. Give me 10 years, I might say, geez, I can't do it anymore. But hopefully there's a positive way to navigate through. So I think, how long am I talking for? I don't want to talk for
5 minutes.
All right, cool. All right. So I think it's important to say what we're trying to do. So what we're definitely not trying to do with Black Studies is diversity. It's not about diversifying the curriculum. It's not about just saying, come and learn about some Black people, come and be taught by Black people, as though that somehow solves any problem. This is not the point, right? I mean, definitely there are Black members of staff. They're one of the reasons we can do Black Studies. If you ask the question of why Black Studies now, it's because we have a collection of Black staff. There's 5, 6 Black members of staff in the department. If you can find any other department in any other university, in any other subject that has 3 Black people, I'll give you a prize. So it literally is a case of why now is we have actually, not, and that's not an accident, we've tried, I wouldn't say the university particularly have tried quite hard to do that. Since I've been there, we've tried quite hard to build a Black Studies research, Black Studies agenda, so we've managed to get staff in. It's just happened on purpose, but not purpose in the university, if that makes sense. But that's not the point, all right? That's not the point. This does not make it definitely, we've certainly started to decolonize the curriculum of sociology. Most of our sociology lecturers are Black. You learn different stuff in our sociology degree than you would have sociology degrees. But I'll just point out straight away, it's not about diversity. That is not the point. So that's one model that the university wants. That's the university model. This is what the university wants with Black Studies. It's diversity. It's different. The equality, whatever it is, that equality agenda, what is it, charter mark, the equality charter mark they're bringing in. I've already seen in documents, they're already mentioning Black Studies all the time. Like, oh yeah, we do Black Studies, great. They just put it in their documentation because it looks good, right? So that's the diversity agenda for the university. We definitely fill that agenda, but it's definitely not the point of the agenda. What we're talking about today is decolonizing. So decolonizing takes that a step further and says, well, look, you've got different people in, can we do something different? Can you transform the way that things work, the curriculum runs? As I said, our sociology degree, I would say, is decolonized. It's a very, you learn lots of broad stuff. You learn about different thinkers. You learn about revolution. You learn about revolution in our degree. You learn about loads of things, right? So I'd say our degree is decolonized. But, and this again will be a challenge, I'm trying to be a little bit provocative here, is if the university is a master's house, to what extent can you actually decolonize the whole curriculum, right? Our degree in sociology is one thing. It's one degree. Has our degree in sociology changed the University of Birmingham degree in sociology, which has no diversity at all, and definitely is not like decolonized, and our degree has no impact on that degree. Our degree has no impact on many other sociology. That is just our degree, which is a different degree, but it's not. It hasn't changed all of sociology, right? In fact, as I was talking to one of my colleagues today, I've actually tried to count how many Black sociologists there are in the country, employed, permanent positions. I've counted 14 in the entire country, including 5 that work at BCU. Right? So this is what happened back. So we haven't even got diversity, generally speaking, so it'll be unlikely that we're going to decolonize the whole entirety of the curriculum. Also, last time I was in Cambridge was for the International Social Theory Conference, and just to be really depressing, I don't think there's any possibility, I'm going to say it right now, social theory is never going to be decolonized. Like, literally never going to be decolonized. It was the worst experience I've ever had in an academic arena. One of my colleagues, Gaminda Bamra, was talking about the Haitian Revolution, and they just dismissed her straight away and said, well, look, the Haitian Revolution is just an offshoot of the French Revolution. Why do we need to learn about Haitian? This is from esteemed professors, people who are supposed to know things, right? The panel on the future of social theory was 7 white men. Really, I'm not joking. It was 7 young white men on the future of social theory. Social theory is not going to be decolonized. So there is a question here. If the purpose of the university is to reproduce racism, maybe it's impossible to challenge the whole curriculum. Maybe that's just not going to happen. Maybe we can do things in our spaces. We can do things differently. But the structure of it, the edifice of it, the point of it, the purpose of it, all of it, it hasn't even got any better. In fact, in some ways, it's getting worse. Right? If you look at the theories that are coming out, they're no better, really, generally speaking. I know that my work on sociology of race has very little impact in other sociology places. Very little impact, right? So we have to sort of be realistic to what we can do. So Black Studies doesn't aim to... How long is it?
Good. 3 more.
So Black Studies isn't even really about decolonizing in a sense. It takes a different tack. What we're actually trying to do is colonize the university space. Really, what we're saying is, look, the ivory tower is the ivory tower. That's not really going to go anywhere. It's probably not going to get, it might make it a bit more equal, possibly. But realistically, it is what it is, and it's a structure we can't do much about. What we can do is colonize that structure and use the resources of the university for other stuff, right? So Black Studies straight away says, and this is one of the guiding principles of our approach to Black Studies, is the point of Black Studies is not the university. The subject of Black Studies is not the university. The point of Black Studies is stuff that's happened outside the university. If you look at where Black Studies emerges originally in America, it's community engagement. It's groups like the Black Panthers. It's very radical politics. They talk about Black Studies as being the science of liberation. How can we use the university to connect to the movements outside the university and use the resources, which there are significant resources, to help challenge racism, structures of racism outside, right? That is the point we're trying to do. This is why I say we're changing what it is that we do. So our work, well, my work, and I say, I'm kind of speaking to everybody in the department, it's probably more me than everybody else, but I would say that definitely my work at least, and the idea of Black Studies is that it's about what can we do to link to the community? How can we change our methodologies? How can we change the way that we think, the way that we interact? And whereas it isn't really about trying to change it, because I just don't know if we can change it. I would also say the university is the master's head. The solution to the problems in our society are not the university. They probably won't be found in the university because the university is the tool of oppression. The university is the master's tool. So actually what we're trying to do is say, actually let's connect to that stuff outside, those movements outside. And can we support them, move them, mobilize them, rally them, and can we be part of them? Can we completely break down this distinction between academia and people, which is one of the central divides of knowledge and ideas, right? Can we really be engaged organic intellectuals and try to push those social movements? So, for example, the work that I'm doing currently, and as mentioned in my introduction, is the organization of Black Unity. This is a Black radical organization we started in Birmingham. And we're doing radical organization work in the community, but we use the university resources. I mean, one of the things we have to accept is that we are quite privileged. Not quite privileged, but very, very, very privileged, right? If you think that the university is a master's house, that's a critique of the university, but every job is a master's house. I mean, we basically live on a plantation. There's no way you're going to work that isn't going to be the master's house, right? Our job, though, does give us a flexibility you don't have in most jobs, right? I can spend 2 days a week, if I want sometimes, working in the organization of Black Unity and writing about it and saying it's research, right? But nobody bothers me, and this is why, right? I can use the space of the university to hold meetings, and I've taken money at the university and used it for organizational stuff, right? Because I have this profession, I have some kind of clout in that institution, and you can do these kind of things, right? There are very few, there's no other job where I could do the work that I do in the organization on the clock, if you like. There's no other job where I could write a book about Black radical ideology on the clock, right? They just don't have these, there's no other space. So we do have lots of privilege, even though it's a master's house. Our role, we have a lot of privilege, we have a lot of access, and this is the point of Black Studies, to use that privilege, to use that access to benefit the things outside, because I'm very skeptical of how much we can change everything. All right, I'm stopped.
I might stand as well. I was hoping to sit down, but just so I can see everyone. Hello, everyone. My name's Kerem. I'm from the University of SOAS, the University of London. I was going to say everything that I was going to say has already been said, basically. I might just build on some of it, maybe speak a bit about the SOAS experience specifically, and that might inform some of the discussion. I want us to critically interrogate the notion of decolonizing universities, and whether or not that's possible at all, or decolonizing the curriculum. Just say a bit about the discipline that I'm working in. I'm a lecturer in international relations. International relations is a remarkably racist discipline. If you think about its primary concerns, which are the politics of the world or the globe, or relations among nations or relations among political communities, you'd think that it would have some awareness or some attention, or pay some attention to things like empire, colonialism, and decolonization. It doesn't at all. It doesn't at all. It's completely silent, as a discipline, it's more or less completely silent in its history on these issues. On the one hand, I guess, if you're talking about decolonizing the curriculum, it's a discipline that's really ripe for this. It's a discipline that's really ripe for this sort of work. Some of the things that we've been doing in terms of things like reading lists and the content of the course is to reintroduce these histories into the very core of what we're teaching. And we do this in, and we've been trying to do this on the Introduction to International Relations course. So starting from the point of empire, starting from the point of colonization, and starting from the point of saying decolonizing and decolonization was a central part of shaping the world that we live in today. And we also do this through sort of, I guess, third year optional courses and so on. We've got a course called Decolonizing the World, where we look at this in more detail. I think there's a couple of reasons why we're able to do this at an institution like SOAS. For starters, there's a remarkably active student body at SOAS who've been pushing for this sort of thing and have created an institutional space that has allowed for this. So if we look at the student union, for example, it's all people of colour in the student union in terms of its offices at the moment. There's also the Decolonizing Our Minds Society, which have been putting on the most like well-attended events at the university. Right, they've been bringing in hundreds of people to speak about these particular issues, to speak about decolonizing. They're probably one of the most well-attended student societies on campus. And so there is this sort of like institutional space, an almost exceptional institutional space at SOAS that is allowing us to do these things, which raises questions of whether or not it's replicable elsewhere without this pressure from below, so to speak. But I guess that's basically a call to arms, right? If you want to do this kind of stuff, then you need to be active, you need to be doing it, you need to be carving out the institutional space to do this stuff. But to pick up on some of the themes that have already been discussed, I also want to talk about some of the dangers and some of the worries, some of the potential pitfalls of framing things in terms of decolonizing. And some of it comes from the existing critiques of diversity. So my friend Dahlia, who's was at Oxford and involved in the Rose Must Fall Oxford movement, frames decolonizing as a sort of like counterposition to diversity, and frames it as a more radical call. And specifically critiques the instances where diversity is effectively presented as a comparative competitive advantage that companies, institutions such as the university can deploy to say, hey, look how great we are. Look at how many people of colour are involved in the running of this institution. It's effectively a branding exercise, right? The worry is that decolonizing is going to fall prey to the same sort of co-option. And in particular, I think this is a real danger in universities, because universities are exceptional institutions. They're different to other kinds of institutions. They're different to other workplaces. They're different to, say, prisons. They're different to, say, a factory, right? In the sense, although the university is, of course, a factory. shut it down, right? It's different in the sense that the university exceptionally positions itself as a space of critical thinking, as a space of doing critical thought. Right? There's no university in the world that you'll find that says, we don't do critical thinking, right? Or that we don't teach people how to think critically. All universities do this. And so, particular forms of critical thinking, such as, say, decolonizing, are potentially sources of comparative advantage for universities. They're potentially things that can be co-opted, brought into universities, commodified, packaged as a 9K a year degree, and sold to students. And this is happening at SOAS. So I was really struck the other day when I looked at The Guardian and I found a puff piece advertising SOAS to potential future students saying, come to SOAS, paid for by SOAS, put in The Guardian. And I was going through it and it showed all, like, look how wonderful SOAS is, there's yoga classes, there's the Hare Krishna people who, like, give free food, and so on. And I was scrolling down and I saw a picture of myself. doing a session that I did for the freshers during Freshers Week on Decolonizing 101. And quite clearly here we have an instance where I've been packaged, modified, and offered to students as something to buy, right? And so there's a real danger there. There's a real danger there of co-option. It's already happening. It's already happening. So I think any kind of project that's pushing towards decolonizing, that wants to decolonize the curriculum or decolonize the university, has to be mindful of co-option. and specifically needs to be mindful of co-option in a way that resists this co-option, right? How do we do radical stuff? How do we do decolonizing in a way that isn't co-optable? How do we do stuff in a way that is toxic, right? How do we do stuff that's toxic to the functioning of the university, that undermines the functioning of the university as a racist institution? That's a question that I don't have answers. I don't have answers to that other than fuck shit up. And so I think that's something that perhaps we can discuss. How do you make decolonizing toxic? How do you make it a challenge to university management? How do you make it genuinely transgressive? And notably, I think what you already said in terms of using the university resources is really instructive in this respect. It's true that the university is packed full of resources that can be used to do stuff outside of universities. And I think one of the things that I think something that's especially important when thinking about even decolonizing the curriculum is really we need to be thinking beyond the curriculum itself. Right. When you start thinking about doing decolonizing, it spills beyond the curriculum. It can't simply stop at a reading list or a syllabus or even teaching practices in the classroom. It pushes beyond that, pushes beyond that boundary. And even when you push beyond that boundary to decolonizing universities as a whole, again, you find yourself compelled to push against that boundary. And one thing that we've been thinking about at SOAS is how we blur the lines between inside and outside of the university. How is it that we make some of the things that are inaccessible to people outside of the university accessible? For example, you need to go through a gate with your student card to get into the library at SOAS. What can you do to render the resources that SOAS has that you have to pay $9,000 a year for? How do you render it common? How do you make it available to more people? But again, there's a danger here. Which is to say that what happened with the introduction of the $9,000 a year regime was also the introduction of the need for things like outreach. And so already within the package of $9,000 a year student fees within the commodified education, there is this idea that there should be some sort of outreach that's being conducted by universities. This has already been commodified. So again, danger there. So how do we push beyond that? How do we make sure the sort of undercommoning that you're speaking of, how do we make sure that this isn't also captured and co-opted by the university? And again, I don't have answers, and so I'd be curious to hear what you think about that. I swear I have one final thing to say, but I can't remember it for the life of me. Co-option, undercommoning. Okay, final thing. Decolonizing itself, and this is maybe the SOAS context, and I'm maybe especially mindful of this because of SOAS. There's a danger, I think, with the concept or the invoking of decolonizing is that it becomes a buzzword, is that it becomes a meme, right? So I've been to all kinds of talks, a lot of them held at SOAS, decolonizing the university, decolonizing curriculum, decolonizing sexuality, decolonizing masculinities, decolonizing food, decolonizing international relations, decolonizing the dance floor, decolonizing banter, so on and so forth. That last one didn't exist. But the point is that when it becomes a buzzword, it's quite useful in the sense that everyone has a sort of starting point, a shared basis that you know you don't have to do the hard work of going up to someone saying we need to decolonize and convince someone of that. But also there's a danger that it becomes emptied of content and it becomes used in ways that have got nothing to do with the project of decolonizing itself. And so we've already been saying the word decolonizing a lot without actually defining what we mean by it, without defining what decolonizing actually means in practice. And there's a real danger of this buzzwordification, if I can coin that term, of the word decolonizing. It becomes emptied of content. As soon as it becomes emptied of content, of course, it's much more co-optable. Right? If it has no radical content to it, it's easy to call stuff decolonizing. It's easy to have a meeting where the pro-director of the university holds a meeting called Decolonizing SOAS, and this is happening. Right, so Valerie Amos, who is our pro-director, Baroness Amos, I should say, is holding a meeting called Decolonizing SOAS. And so... So yeah, I'd push people to define it, and I'd be interested to hear on people's definitions what you think decolonising means. I'll just refer to Fanon and say that decolonising is a project of complete disorder. Project of complete disorder. Right, how do you do that in a university? How do you create disorder in a university? So again, yeah, fuck shit up. But I'm really interested to hear your thoughts. But thank you.
Tell is quite different, and I think hopefully will indicate the ways in which some of the politics and the institutional bases that you're talking about here are configured very differently from where I'm standing, which is at the Department of Geography here at Cambridge, in which we have a very white staff, we have a very white British student body, not an international body, about 5-10% of our students are from outside the UK, and in which, however, we have a very strong tradition of radical critique coming from within the discipline, which has been talking about issues around colonialism and race since the 60s, which is still a very vibrant and very exciting debate within the discipline as a series of critiques of the ways in which colonialism goes on having an impact in the colonial present. The colonial present is a term coined by Derek Gregory to discuss what's been happening in the Middle East. And so geographers from the first year are introduced to issues around the impact of colonialism and the ongoing reproduction of colonialism as integral to the way in which they should understand the world. The impetus for this is coming from members of staff, okay? And there are a number of different issues. We consider colonization as related to economic inequalities, the production of huge gulfs in well-being, wealth, and security for people across the world. We consider colonization to be expressed very strongly in the way in which people imagine their world and make divisions within that world between different areas, whether those are around issues of race or poverty or within the city. And we also talk about racialization, but we also talk, because geography is positioned at the interface between human and natural sciences, we're very interested in environment, and one of the main ways in which colonialism has been expressed is through the domination and the appropriation of nature, especially when that nature belongs to people who are not white and Western. So we take a very broad view of colonization, and hence any thinking about decolonization is also trying to work across those very disparate fields. So the way in which I wanted to sort of talk a little bit about the theme of our meeting today is to go back to Spivak's discussion of unlearning one's privilege as a loss, okay? And this is about going beyond the curriculum, perhaps. Actually, it's great that Karen sort of said, trying to get beyond the curriculum, because I was thinking, well, what are we trying to do with students in our department? are we saying that they are that they have lost out on learning about the ways in which colonialism has produced their world, has produced their privilege? Are they really just vessels that we want to fill with our ideas and the sort of reverse of the banking model of education, perhaps? Or is it rather that we have to think about the ways in which we teach students and engage students in critical thinking and those forms of critical thinking that will go with them into the world? And so this is where I think that theme that's been discussed already about that breaking down those boundaries between the university and outside the university are really important. And so what is the sort of way in which that might impact the way that we're trying to raise a critical debate within geography? There's a number of different things, which are maybe specific to the discipline, but also I think we should speak to other areas. The one is that a lot of students coming into geography are very enthusiastic about changing the world. They believe that there is a huge inequality that constitutes the world, and many of them are inspired by visions for informing a better form of development, and many of them are also incredibly concerned about environmental degradation and want to challenge that and learn about that. By the time they get to the end of their second year, they have been exposed to so much negative criticism of efforts to conserve, efforts to develop, that they are, very disenchanted with the world. And so the way that I see this is that in the third year, we have to build back into their thinking. They've lost some of their security about their role in the world as being good do-gooders and going out to intervene to do something. But we have to articulate and create conversations with those students to try and get them to think critically about the histories, the configurations of power, the ways in which those are reproduced through their own choices, through their own political engagements, in order to try and provide them not with a content, not with the content of a curriculum, the things that they've read, but rather how does that curriculum get them into a pattern of critical thinking in which they are more aware of their situation in the world, their position in the world, and more able to understand where very powerful critiques are coming from, and think very carefully about the forms of solidarity that can be created on the basis of that. So this is, I think, a sort of self-reflexive praxis, which is about teaching about forms of protest and contestation and racism and colonialism and so on. But it's also about creating an awareness of where they might trip up against neocolonialism, either in volunteerist tourism, which is a very strongly embedded practice within sort of geography undergraduates, but also in terms of informing what they go out and do in the world, whether that's in the City of London or in a non-governmental organisation. And I suppose that I think that in a way we've got, the position that I see there is very different to a situation of Black studies where there is the opportunity to create, if you like, a sort of space within the university. And it's also different, perhaps, to Karim's argument that one can try and systematically change the curriculum from one, from the first to the third year. And so I'd be very interested to hear from those of you who have, you know, because I think there is a very interesting position, and I'm very conscious of this myself, having done work as a British academic with marginalised indigenous female subjects within Latin America, that the politics of solidarity are incredibly complex. And I think that that's an issue that is something that I would be very interested to know how we might talk through that and to understand the ways in which the kind of politics that entails for a white academic teaching in a predominantly white university to a predominantly white group of students. Thanks.